Call the Committee on Housing to order. And it looks like we don't have quite a quorum, but we'll get started without that. And Representative Isaacson, your bill is here before us. Oh, and now we have, maybe we have a quorum. Let's see.
So exciting.
I'm missing one. We're going to get started. Representative Isaacson, welcome to your committee.
Thank you.
And if you want to start with your bill, we'll make the proper motion in just a few minutes.
Do you want me to wait for the proper motion?
No. Just go ahead and why don't you start introducing the bill to us and we'll...
All right. Let me know when you want the proper motion. All right?
Sure.
House File 1191 is a pretty aggressive look at how we should be funding and beginning to take on the issue of homelessness more so than we have. It's asking the governor to go beyond what his budget is. But I want to take a step back for a second and explain why I'm sponsoring this bill in the first place. I think it's important to recognize that many of the times in government we spend too much time with the boiling pot theory of management, where we're taking what's coming over the top of the pot and we're not looking at the source of the problem at the bottom. And I think that when we're looking at the issue of homelessness and the issue of housing, I'm finding that, in many cases, that is part of the root cause for many of the economic woes we have down the line. And so, for me, this issue isn't just about making sure that we do the right thing ethically. It isn't about a moral responsibility. It isn't just about making sure our kids are safe. But there's an added component that it's a fiscally responsible thing to do. And I mean that in all sincerity. It is a fiscally responsible thing to do. Because every ounce of effort we put in on the front end saves us 10 ounces of effort on the back end to fix a problem that we have in society. Does that mean it's a catch-all? No. Does this bill solve that? No, it doesn't come close. There's way more than that needed. But when I was approached by the Minnesota Homes for All, what they said to me was, help us out in getting a little bit more funding and let us show you what we can do. And if we do our job, then maybe you'll help us get some more funding after that. They're saying, we want to be accountable just like everybody else. We want to do the right thing like everybody else. We want to prove through outcomes that we're here to help solve the homelessness problem, to help solve part of our housing crisis. And I have a great deal of respect for that. And I think the second part that's important to be noted before we start is that this is a coalition of 50 groups. It's not just one group. It's a coalition of 50 groups. Now, if you've ever been involved in nonprofit work, as I have, getting two groups to agree is quite the accomplishment. Getting 50 groups to come onto the same page is a miracle, right? That reason alone is enough for me to say we need to at least reward them for some real synergy, real getting together and helping to tackle a problem. But I think that speaks to the depth of the commitment and the importance of this issue. And so I really wanted to just set the tone a little bit on why I chose this bill, why I'm very passionate about this bill, and why I think not only is it the moral and ethical thing to do, but it is simply the fiscally responsible thing to do long term. So with that, we're not at a quorum, are we?
We are. So Representative Isaacson, you want to move your bill?
Yep. I'd like to move House File 1194 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
And so I have a series of testifiers of people who are probably not only smarter but better versed in a lot of these issues specifically, and I'd like to let them just kind of, we're going to go through a group of folks. Some here are to talk about specific stories related to this. Some have some technical expertise, and I'm always happy to stand for questions as well at any time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If the first person will introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. My name is Darielle Dan, and I'm the co-chair of the Homes for All Coalition. So I get to be the one who's spending a lot of time getting the more than two organizations to work collaboratively together. And I think we've been in front of this committee many times, but I do just want to remind folks that these are folks who are, on-the-line service providers, people who are day-to-day seeing people struggling in their communities. And we really got together about 2 years ago now and said, what can we do strategically together to really make an impact on the need that's out there? And so today we have a number of testifiers, and they're really folks who are sort of, again, on the ground, able to tell those community stories about, what the programs that we have, what they do, and what they can do. And really, if we provide those smart investments in those programs, how we can impact our communities. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to George Stone to talk a little bit.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stone. You just introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Stone, and I am the Minnesota Director of CSH. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of House File 1194. CSH is a national nonprofit that uses housing solutions to improve the lives of the most vulnerable people and communities across the country and have supported the creation of supportive housing movements here in Minnesota since 1993. We deliver expertise, ideas, information, and capital for housing solutions that integrate supportive housing and intervention using housing as a platform for services. Supportive housing is proven to work for people struggling with complex and serious challenges like homelessness, and it's also a more effective use of limited public resources. I know this committee has already heard informative and impassioned testimony regarding Minnesota housing appropriations, so I'll try and make my comments brief. What you may not know about this bill is how it came to be. Advocates and funders have struggled for years to impress upon the legislature the great need and value of additional state investment in affordable housing. However, due to the scarcity of available resources, at the end of the day, we often found ourselves divided and forced to settle for whatever we could garner for our own particular interests. The Homes for All campaign, the effort behind this bill, represents a shift in our approach. We present a comprehensive and coordinated request based on critical needs across the affordable housing and supportive services spectrum. House File 1194 represents half of our united request, the housing side. It is a multifaceted request that addresses numerous proven programs that help stabilize families, prevent and end homelessness, and create workforce housing. I won't be going into the granular detail of some of the particular funding needs. Rather, I thought I would take this opportunity to highlight how some of these programs have become invaluable tools and used by many of our partners to address one of the housing needs closest to my own concerns, ending homelessness. First program I'd like to address is the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program, FHPAP. According to data provided by Minnesota Housing Finance, between 2010 and 2011, this program served more than 16,000 households across the state. This is a program that meets the pragmatic needs of families at risk of homelessness. Everything from rental deposit and payment assistance to mortgage and transportation expense assistance. Prevention, by nature, meets the cost-conscious concerns of government. They say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In this case, that's a great example. FHPHP costs roughly $840 per household versus the thousands of dollars often needed to provide emergency shelter once a family has gone into homelessness. For those who might be concerned that programs like this are imbalanced in terms of their geographic reach, let me assure you this is not the case. 44.8% of FHPAP funds were allocated to Greater Minnesota. We are seeking a proposed increase in this program of $2.5 million over the next biennium for a total base funding proposal of $17.4 million. The Housing Trust Fund is another program that plays a critical role in the way Minnesota responds to homelessness. The program provides rental assistance for households that have experienced homelessness and is used in both site-based and scattered-based settings. Additionally, the Housing Trust Fund provides capital finance for the development, construction, acquisition, preservation, and rehabilitation of low-income rental housing. I'm aware that earlier this week, a colleague of mine testified regarding the use of Housing Trust Fund rental assistance programs by his agency, St. Stephen's Human Services. I know he shared stories of who he has served and how they've leveraged those funds with other federal, state, and local resources. I would like to share some additional information to further demonstrate the importance of this program. Hearth Connection, another local nonprofit that offers supportive housing through a network of providers through three regional programs, also relies heavily on Housing Trust Fund rental assistance to support over 350 households per year, 225 of which were families with 442 children. Like FHPAP, Housing Trust Fund has tremendous reach, and Hearth Connection uses approximately 43% of this resource in Greater Minnesota, specifically in the northeast and southern parts of Minnesota. We are seeking the restoration of $2 million and an additional investment of $2.5 million for the total biennial base of $23.6 million for this program. Lastly, I would like to say a word about capacity building grants provided through Minnesota Housing. Among the most important uses of this program is to support Greater Minnesota Continuums of Care, or COCs. COC staff are responsible for organizing and delivering housing and services such as prevention, outreach, and assessment, emergency shelter, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing. The COCs are able to access over $20 million in funds annually through the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Program application process. We are asking for, again, a restoration of $250,000 and an additional investment of $250,000 for a biennial total of $750,000 for capacity building programs. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak, According to the latest information released by Wilder, we know that housing remains out of reach for far too many Minnesotans, especially children and youth. We also know what works to fix the problem, but we must make the necessary investments to implement these solutions. I would argue that reforming the way our state responds to homelessness isn't a matter of big or small government. Rather, it's a matter of smart government. Thank you very much. And I do have some pieces of information with more detail that I'll be handing out to the page.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. And if the panel just stay there, because we might have questions from the committee after. Next speaker. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Iglesias. I am here from Winona and Fillmore County. I'm the executive director of the Habitat affiliate in that area. I've served as executive director for about the last 18 years, and over that time have had the joy of seeing 48 families partner with Habitat to become homeowners and to have the opportunity to now live and own a simple, decent, and affordable home. I want to talk to you today about the impact that the challenge funding has had in the communities that we serve. But before I begin, I want to take the opportunity to say thank you. Thank you for your commitment in the past to affordable housing. Thank you for investing in Habitat affiliates all over the state of Minnesota. And thank you for choosing wisely to partner with Habitat Minnesota. I had the privilege of serving on their board, their state board, for 6 years, and I can tell you there are great people doing good things all over the state of Minnesota. I can speak confidently for all of my Habitat colleagues that we do not take your investment in our work lightly. And on behalf of the additional families that we've been able to serve, you have our deepest gratitude. Because of the grassroots nature of what we do, we rely heavily on our community partners. Serving as both the builder and the lender, our task of resourcing all that we need to come alongside of a family can be daunting. For Habitat affiliates like ours around the state of Minnesota who are building 3 to 5 homes in relatively small communities, it's no small task to raise the necessary funds each year to build our homes. Our staff, volunteers, donors, and community partners are working extremely hard to meet the growing needs of families who need a hand up and not a handout. I just want you to know that the funding that you have passed in the past and we are considering now certainly is making a huge difference. Over the last 5 rounds of challenge funding, nearly $100,000 has come to Winona and Fillmore County. Those funds have allowed us to partner with 7 families, and each of those families have a story. Today, I want to tell you one of those stories. This story began in the summer of 2007 when devastating floods ravaged through the southeastern Minnesota, in particular, the community of Rushford. Nearly 2/3 of the homes in Rushford were affected by the flood. Resources in Rushford were stretched thin. Our Habitat affiliate was asked to come to Rushford to help with the recovery work. Thanks to the great support of Habitat Minnesota, who was able to supply a VISTA volunteer to do community development, we were able to help that community pull together the resources they needed to build a Habitat home. 2 years later, that home was completed, the family moved in, and a single mom and 3 children, she was working at a restaurant, ended up marrying one of the chefs at the local Perkins in Winona, and together they began to dream about what it would take for them to own a restaurant. The Birdie's home in Rushford was built with extremely energy-efficient insulated concrete forms, and the first 2 years they spent in their home, their average heating bill was about $70 a month. Because of the affordable nature of both their mortgage and now their utilities, the Birdies were able to reinvest their earnings back into their community. On March 1st, just 2 weeks ago, Kristen Eckern and her husband took over as the new owners of Judy's Restaurant, now called Birdie's Cafe, in nearby Peterson, Minnesota. Not only is Kristen's family living and thriving as homeowners and as busy parents of 4 children, they're contributing to the economic vitality of southeastern Minnesota in a very tangible way. I'd say that's a win-win for everyone. If you have occasion to travel to southeastern Minnesota, stop in at Birdie's Cafe and meet Kristen. She'll be only too happy to tell you about her experience with Habitat. And besides that, she makes a mean pie. While it's only one story, I do believe that there are no doubt countless other similar stories amongst the 107 homes that have received challenge funding. You should be so proud that your funding truly is making a difference. Your funding is working hard alongside of the funding that we raise in our local communities. It's allowing us to extend the opportunity of homeownership to additional families who are working and contributing in a positive way to their communities. As we often say in Habitat Circles, we're building much more than houses. We're building hope, we're building families, we're building communities. Habitat is not about building dream homes, but it is about making the dream of homeownership a reality for families in need. Because of the appropriations made by this committee in the past, each of you have a little investment in our Habitat homes and now in places like Birdie's Cafe. Thank you for giving the gift of hope to this family. I look forward to many more stories of hope.
Thank you, Ms. Iglesias.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on Petty Wash Day, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Bill Ziegler. I am President and CEO of Little Earth of United Tribes in South Minneapolis. Thank you for allowing us to come and address y'all and talk with y'all about the importance of funding for housing. Little Earth is unique in that we are the only Indian preference housing community in the nation. The only place that you'll find a community like this is on reservations. We're not on reservations. We're right in South Minneapolis. Little Earth is, I think, exists and is has Indian preference housing, I think, fundamentally for one reason. And I think that reason is potentially as an answer to the misguided federal policy of relocation. Throughout the years, within our community, we've seen a ton of peaks and valleys, more valleys than peaks. I came to the job in 2004, December 2004, I was hired. I'm from a little reservation in central South Dakota. I'd never been to a city, had never addressed a committee like y'all before. But what I brought with me, I think, was a fundamental understanding and a belief in how communities work and how we can change a community from within. And frankly, the only way to empower and change a community is from within. I think for too many years as American Indian people, our futures and our lives were being dictated to us through outside forces. And if you take a look at the condition that we were in as Indian people, it's obvious that those outside forces didn't work. People didn't know, and government agencies didn't know what was best for us as Indian people. We know what's best for us. So when I came into Little Earth, and a little background on our community, we have 212 housing units. We have over approximately 1,000 residents officially. Unofficially, we have upwards of 2,000 people living in our community. We don't like that there's folks that are living in our community that aren't necessarily on the lease. But the fact of the matter is, if they're not living in our community, they're living on the streets. We have over 565 American Indian families on our waiting list trying to gain housing at Little Earth. There's not a week that goes by that I don't sit in front of a young mother who's in tears crying because she's homeless. She has no place to go. She's begging for housing at Little Earth. I have a 5-year waiting list. There's not enough housing out there for people. So when I came into Little Earth, I stepped into a situation where my first 6 months on the job, there are 5 gang homicides right within our community. We're inner city, we're south side, we're tough, we're mean, but the people didn't want that life. We're tired of seeing our young people die. We're tired of burying our kids. So I came with this philosophy of how we change community, and again, it's only from within that it's sustainable. So we set out through a collaboration with the University of Minnesota and a couple funders, we set out to do a major look at our community through a huge resident survey where we asked the people, what do you see, Littler? How do you see your community today? Where would you like to see the community 10 years from now? And then more importantly, what's your responsibility to be that change? Over the past 8 years, what we've been successful in doing is lowering our crime by over 60%. In 2012, we reached a decade-long crime within our community. The amount of money that I spend on off-duty policing, I cut by over 60%. So I'm putting less money out there for policing of our community, and we're still seeing that crime rate continually go down. We partnered with Hennepin County a number of years ago to create our own social service delivery model, again, with my philosophy and belief that the Western way of doing work within our community wasn't effective. It didn't work. We weren't seeing our young mothers and our families get up out of poverty. right? It doesn't matter how many generations they're in the system, they couldn't figure out how to move from poverty to prosperity. So we approached Hennepin County and we rewrote the way social services are delivered within our community. 2 months ago, the county approached me and sent in a company with a letter saying that they are adopting our Lidler style of social service delivery countywide. So what we created within our community, what our people created, is being done throughout the entire county now. It's an approach to social service work. At that time, 6 years ago, I knew that if we're successful, if we do what we're supposed to do as a community, and we help our families move, again, from welfare to work, and help our families overcome some of the social issues that we've been facing for generations, we knew that ultimately what would happen is we'd have a mass exodus out of our community. Right, that didn't sit well with me. I didn't want to see our most stable families leave Littler. So I had this crazy concept. Well, you know, home ownership would be awesome. Right, there's a block directly south of our community that was potentially the worst block of South Minneapolis at that time. That's where the drugs were coming from. That's where the homicides and the gangs. We pushed them out of our community. They moved across the street and continued to try to prey upon our community. So we had this concept of home ownership. And when I start talking about this within the community, because you know, I'm looking at the rent rolls and I know how much our tenants make, how much income they have, and we had a lot of folks that are paying darn near market rent. And it just didn't make sense to me. I'm looking at the waiting list, 565 families. 30 families are paying almost market rent. Y'all need to move on because we have other families that need housing here. And so in conversations with the community, I was pitching the concept, what about home ownership? Two responses I got back immediately from every family I talked to. Number one, I don't think I could. I can't own a home. You know, our families, our people had never thought about individual home ownership. And the second, in addition to that, folks didn't want to leave the comfort of being within their own community and the support system that we had built over the years. And the second thing our families talked about was, I got bad credit, right? So my thought was, okay, we can address these issues, and we set out working on these issues with our families. I didn't realize that it would take 6 years before we finally start building homes, but that's what it's taken. It's taken us 6 years to finally get to the place where we're developing. The thing that I think surprised me the most about this home ownership initiative that we built, and again, realize that up until this point, American Indian home ownership had reached urban legend status, right? And we heard Indian people own homes, but we ain't ever seen it, right? So it was important for us to develop right within our own community so our young families could have something to emulate, something to look up to. Not just, again, urban legend of Indian home ownership, but I could look across the street. I'm in my townhouse, my subsidized rental townhouse. I could look across the street, and I could see an Indian family that they used to be my neighbor, and they're living in this beautiful home right here in the community. They're still part of the community. They're still taking part in all our programs and our cultural events, etc. Something amazing happened when we started developing these homes, and it's something I didn't account for. Now, realize that when we set out on this journey, I wasn't about building individual homes. That's not what I wanted to do. What I was trying to achieve was, how do we build community? How do we make sure and guarantee that we start having a mix of income within our community, that the examples of prosperity and the examples of success stay within our community? Something happened along the line. Number one, folks weren't applying. And I'm like, are you kidding me? We're building these homes. Y'all need it. It's amazing the way we put this thing together. The state of Minnesota Housing came in with some gap assistance for us, and our folks weren't applying. So finally, after a series of community meetings, I asked the question. I said, what gives, guys? What else can I do? And really what it came down to is something I should have thought of, but I didn't. The concept of individual ownership was counterintuitive to who we are as American Indian people, right? It almost felt like, and what was, I guess, verbalized back to me was, but if we do this, if we look out for ourselves, our own families, we're turning our back on our entire community. And so it took us a long time and a lot of talking within the housing community that you're not turning your back on your community by becoming a homeowner. You're forging a new path, a new direction that we don't go as Indian people. So we need our champions to do this. So it's happened. Our people are applying. We have over 33 families in process for the first five homes that we built. The other thing that I didn't think of and I didn't think would happen, but I'm thrilled, 60% of the folks who are in application for our homes in our community aren't current residents of Littler. Now, when I look at that and I think about that, I'm telling y'all, 8 years ago, we couldn't get a pizza guy to deliver pizza in our community. Mm-hmm. Right, things, we've done our work. Things are better in our community, and they're better because we did it, because we made a decision within our community that we're going to no longer give power to the past. We're no longer going to give power to the injustices that were forced upon us as American Indian people, but we're going to stand up, and we're going to take control of our futures, and that's what we've done, and that's why we've seen success in our community. And I ask you as leaders of the state to go on this journey with us. Make sure that we have the ability to continue to forge that path for American Indian families, so we don't have an anomaly that, you know, once upon a time, Littler was able to help five families build homes, but it went away. Help us so it doesn't go away. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ziegler. And I want to just point out to committee members, there's a really a nice handout that you have that talks about the Little Earth Housing Initiative. Hang around, Bill. There might be some questions. Okay, the next speaker is Tanya Bett.
Sorry.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, members of the committee. My name is Tanya Beck, and I'm the site manager for one of Aon's affordable communities in Roseville. Our property benefits from funding sources like low-income housing tax credits, and we have project-based Section 8 units and GRH-funded long-term homeless units. In the 5 years that I've been on the property, I've watched the transformation from an ill-cared for, unsafe, unsanitary property in Roseville, if you would believe it, with prostitution, drugs. It was terrible. My first 3 weeks in the job, there was a SWAT team on the ground. I'm still there. and now it's a thriving, beautiful, quality, mission-driven community that houses houses incomes of the full spectrum. We have 17 market rate units that never turn over, and every other one of them has some sort of subsidy. Just a real quick story about an individual that we helped with our new 2 and 3 bedroom tax credit housing this last summer. A woman was forced to flee her housing because of her abusive boyfriend with their 2 children that were under 2. She showed up in our office and within minutes was in tears. She couldn't figure out how to get a deposit. She had a livable income of $40,000, which for 3 people isn't a lot. And we were able to work with her through the process. Her landlord let her out of the lease because he didn't want to deal with the police calls and the complaints. So we were able to help her procure a deposit and settle her and her 2 kids in Roseville, which is an amazing community with great schools and a really stable opportunity for future. Now she can focus her 2 part-time job income on what's left of it on childcare and insurance and food, and that's something that is a luxury for a lot of people. We've got folks that are on disability. We've got folks that have worked the same service industry jobs for 20 years that were paying. I met folks that had been paying close to 70% of their income for housing the way the property was when we took it on, that now we're eligible for Section 8 subsidies and can take care of their health care needs or just the basic living needs. And the community doesn't look like affordable housing. We turn away people every day that want to live there that make, you know, really decent incomes. And we watch folks that come into the housing with really low incomes age out of it. Folks that come in 1-bedroom unit that rents at $670 a month, and by the time they get married and have a child, they make far too much money to move into our 2-bedroom units. Mm-hmm. So I guess I just want to say that I think that having seen the progress, individual progress, or just the stability and safeness that this type of housing can provide to folks, it gives them the opportunity to try to plan for their futures that you don't have time to when you can't plan where you're going to sleep. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tanya. For your testimony. Let's see, I think.
Madam Chair? One more person to speak, if that's okay.
Yes.
And then I wanted to, and I think what we're going to do is just walk you through what the bill does. Because as you know, we heard the governor's budget, and this is fairly similar to that, with two exceptions, and I want to, the first exception being the most important, that we're asking more than the government in every line item, but the line items are largely the same, except for one part in that we did not include from the governor's budget in this budget that we will roll into it that we just didn't ask for an increase for. So this is only focused on where the increases were,
okay,
just so we're all clear about that. But perhaps you could introduce yourself and kind of walk us through it briefly.
Yep. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, my name is, like I said earlier, my name is Darielle Dannon, and I'm the co-chair of the Homes for All Coalition. And I think everyone is probably fairly familiar. You're probably sick of seeing us by now. We're the folks who, like Representative Isaacson said, who've kind of been putting together this push for additional appropriations for Minnesota housing. I guess our intention with our speakers earlier was just to really showcase what many of these programs do. I know it can be really confusing from the outside, because a lot of these programs work together. They work with federal programs, with local dollars, and I mean, the intention is to actually leverage as much as possible so that our state dollars go as far as possible, but it does mean that at the end of the day, it gets a little confusing. I've had lawmakers in the past say, well, can't you just have one or two programs? And I try to explain, well, you know, we've created many, many programs to sort of fit many needs in many communities, and so they often work together and interact. Like the testifier in the Aon property was saying, you know, in one building even, there could be many, many sources of funds and many different dollars there just to fit everyone's needs. And I did want to mention that Bill from Little Earth, I know he didn't, when we talked before this, I made a promise to him that he didn't have to be an expert in the technical details, that he could tell the story about his community, and that's, I think, how we got him here today. But the dollars, the state dollars that went into that project were challenge funds. So if you're looking at the bill and you're wondering where those are challenge dollars. So to walk you through the bill, I think it's pretty straightforward. Really what we're intending to do is go a little bit farther than where the governor went. So really provide additional increases in challenge funds. One of the reasons for that is that's the most flexible source of funding, so we can do things like we can build multifamily rental housing like the Aon property. We can and rehab properties like that. We can also do things like the Little Earth Project. We can do land trust housing like Habitat for Humanity. Things like that all can come from the challenge fund. Another big area that we've put increases are the Housing Trust Fund. As George Stone was talking about, that's really a place where people can get assistance today for the difference between what they make and what their housing will cost. So both of those pieces are really important big pieces where we've provided additional funding. You'll also notice that there's additional funds provided in the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Fund. And as you can imagine right now, we have more folks that we can than we can serve going to agencies asking for assistance. And those are often very short-term pieces of assistance, but somebody loses a job, they have a little gap before they get another job, things like that. So really intending to keep people in their home or help them transition out of shelter into home ownership or actually rental housing. So really providing that that security deposit. That's what that essentially does. So I think those are sort of the high points of the bill. Is there anything else you want me to cover?
I think that I just wanted you to talk about explaining it to
us. Yeah. And I guess the last thing that we haven't mentioned but you can know is in here is the HECAT funding, and that goes to the foreclosure prevention counseling dollars and also to home buyer assistance. So like I said, all these programs, you know, either fortunately or unfortunately, really work together and, you know, overlap sometimes.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? And the first person we want to speak is Representative Mariani.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Stanton, for your presentation. I'm wondering if I kind of ask a question quickly and perhaps have our guests from Little Earth also join
Mr. Ziegler
in answering this. So I was very taken by your presentation, sir, in terms of the power of this of the mix of these kind of programs with, I guess, what we would call here in the legislature, emerging communities. Of course, with your community, it's really the first communities. but I think from a policy perspective, what we have is a dominant policy frame that was not developed with your community and other communities in mine. And so my question to both of you has to do with, so what is sort of the state of affairs relative to the relevancy of this rich, you know, array of programs to communities like yours? is the ease of translation, is the ease of use, is that actually happening? Or are communities like our first communities and other communities sort of having to reinvent the wheel and figure out how to best connect with our state program? So I'm just looking for, you know, I suppose an update about the relevancy and the power that's happening between state-funded programs and community-based programs.
Mrs. Ziegler?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I approached, and I can't speak for other Indian organizations or other Indian communities. I can only speak on behalf of Little Earth. In my approach, when I do my work, whether it's work with the state or whomever, I don't have enough sense to be fearful, is what it amounts to. And I have a pretty amazing staff behind me that I task them with actually doing the work. I actually don't do anything. I don't tell my staff that. My staff has to do all the work. You know, I haven't found a lot of barriers, to be honest with you. Okay. I'm not saying they don't exist, right? But I'm just saying from my perspective, what I continually do, if we come across a barrier in within an institution, the first thing I do isn't necessarily to point fingers at that institution and declare institutional racism. My job, or what I do, is look at my own community and say, okay, what do we need to do to make sure we're qualified? Or what we need to take control and power over things that we have the power to control, right? So to make sure that whatever that we have to learn the process. If we don't know the process, how can we fault the state? That's our responsibility to learn that process. So I haven't seen huge barriers. I think the barrier historically has been almost a philosophical barrier. How can we as American Indian people ever trust the government? Right? And a little known fact for y'all here, I'm not sure if y'all know this, I'm going to share this with you. Federal government, not talking state government, federal government did keep one promise to Indian people. We talk about broken trees, and we talk about all the broken promises. They did keep one. They promised to take our land, and they did. So, no, we are a little fearful historically in dealing with government agencies, but we got to get over it. If we want to be competitive, if we want to have a bright future as a community, we need to get over it. We need to learn the process. We need to educate ourselves so we can take advantage of things that are available to us. Thank you.
Ms. Dannon, did you care to respond to that question?
Sure, I'm happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Mariani, I didn't mention this at the beginning, but my organization that I actually work at is the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, and we're a membership organization that has about 50 members, and many of those folks, they're community development organizations, so they include different organizations that are identify with some of the different emerging groups in our communities, so the Hmong American Partnership, just throwing some out off the top of my head, but the idea is that we actually work with organizations as they emerge and are representing individual people, so really help get them up to speed. And we work also in collaboration with Minnesota Housing to get them up to speed, help them kind of figure out the resources that they need. So Little Earth is actually a great example because they're partnering with one of our other members, City of Lakes Community Land Trust, who had that expertise of building those land trust homes and really kind of came together so that it could be a partnership project to hopefully build some of that knowledge within Little Earth. I think their intention is that Little Earth will eventually have that knowledge to be able to run completely their own development program.
Representative Mariani.
I'm really comforted to hear the responses of both of you on this issue. And I think for us, you know, as policymakers here, it's really important that we hear that what's happening out in the field has to do with a constant drive to build relationships that are also that are delivering important government resources to help build communities, but are also about driving new skills, new competencies, new learnings that cut across communities, that cut across races, that cut across people, so that what we do here in terms of appropriating resources faces a higher guarantee of success. And I think that's a really important shift, Madam Chair, in terms of policy, you know, for state government, that this isn't just about, you know, putting resources out without any, expectation of a return. And part of the return here really has to do with this raised level of competency, if you will. I'm not sure that's a quite word, but you know, something around quality assurance, around people's learning from one another, because if we're going to beat things like poverty, it's going to require a heck of a lot more than charity. It's going to require a lot of skill development that happens both ways. And there's a lot for us to learn in government from communities like Little Earth. And obviously, as we heard from Little Earth, there's a lot that community can learn from some of the wisdoms and competencies that we've developed and invested in state government programs over the years. So anyway, thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, some good stories here today, or some good things said, and appreciate the Little Earth comment. Very, very good. This is a short bill, relatively two pages, and it contains a lot of funding in it. Are there any further breakdowns of where the money is going to go more specifically? We're looking at, I think it was House File 729, having some housing trust money and the challenge grants, and that's really broken down there where the funding is going to go. So just concerned about this is kind of a generalized appropriation, and are there more specifics to where it's going to go?
Madam Chair?
Representative Isaacson.
That's a good question, and I think that part of our thinking was, because this bill, in almost its exact entirety except the amounts, was already gone over once, like 2 days ago, from the governor, I wanted to save some of the time and not go through each line by line again. I'd be happy to, but I don't think anybody, you know, really wants to meet it. See that exact line by line again. What it is is just think of what they were doing, and we're going to expand that to be a little farther, right? And I'm happy to put a brief or something together, maybe a little bit more detail for you or anybody offline, just to give you that understanding. I don't want there to be any misconceptions or misunderstandings about it.
Representative Anderson.
And thanks. And a question for you, Madam Chair. Has this committee received its spending target yet? Or how much are we going to have to work with in this committee?
Thank you for that question. We haven't yet. And part of, I'm hoping it'll be shortly. We've been pushing, and part of the benefit of having this hearing and the other discussions we've had about the need and so on is we are applying some positive pressure to our leadership to make sure that we get some of the funding that we need. So we don't have the targets yet. Committee members will be the first to know when we get it. Anything else? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of along those same lines, I'm a numbers person. I was just curious as to what the 2012-2013 base appropriations were in these categories. I don't know if you have that handout again. What's the total at the bottom?
Representative Isaacson, if you don't have that, I have it, but if you have it, you can provide the information. Representative O'Neill, just for the record, in the actual funding in 2012-2013, which I think is your question, the total was $76 million, and that's a cut, actually, of 25, let's see, no, over this two bienniums is a $40 million cut. So one of the things that's happened with our opportunity to do affordable housing in Minnesota is that we have seen cut after cut after cut, and it started way back in 2010-11. The high point was in 2008-09 of 114 plus million. So we're down, and we're trying to come back somewhat. Is that helpful?
So, Madam Chair, it was at $76 million, and the current ask, I believe, Representative Hertaus just added up, is 95 is what's on the bill, million.
Wait, that's correct.
95 million.
It's actually 114 million. Let's see. That's we're having a little chat here. I think
Madam Chair,
Representative Mariani is pointing out that it was previously in 2008 and 2009 114 million, and we're down. We went down to 76 million, and we're with this proposal.
So, Madam Chair?
100. Pardon me.
Yes, Representative O'Neill, if you look at the bottom, it says an increased appropriations of $25 million on the sheet that I just handed you, and then when we actually added it all up and negotiated it out, we ended up with an increase of $21 million. So just, I just want to make it clear that that's where that came from.
Okay. I think, and just an important thing to point out is that increase doesn't get us back to where we were yet in 2008 and 2009. So we're taking a moderate step forward. I hope we're taking a moderate step forward. This is the proposal.
Please.
Representative O'Neill?
I was just going to say, so the 2008-2009, isn't that the same time that we had a lot of, was it just after that, the unallotments? And I'm just trying to kind of get a frame of reference as to why that would be a cut right after that. Did we have a severe budget crisis at that point?
Let's see.
Madam Chair,
yes, she's saying
Madam Chair, that's exactly what was. Yep. Is we had a understandably, the government had to tighten its belt at that time because of the recession, and this is part of where the cuts came down in negotiations between the two parties at the time.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and in kind of follow up with Representative Anderson's comments about, you know, what is our target appropriation as a housing committee. And I heard you say we don't know yet, and I appreciate the fact that we look at the needs and maybe try and figure out what some of those are, but I just want to express a concern that I hope that we're not spending and then taxing, as opposed to taxing and then spending with what we can afford. So we seem to have gone awry in this state for the last several years where we spend first and then we try and balance what we've spent.
You know, Representative Hertas, I love your comment because the last bill on the agenda today is to talk about how we would raise some of the money first. And it's not new. We talked about this bill last time, but we needed to have an amendment to it, so we'll come back to that. It's the mortgage registry and deed tax. So, Representative Isaacson, we have, I believe we have one person. Oh, was there another question? Representative Mariani.
I don't want to belabor the point because this gets into macro politics and macroeconomics. We don't need to do that. We have Representative Isaacson's bill here, which stands on its own, and we've heard some powerful testimony on the need for it. One of the things that we're going to constantly struggle with, Mr. Representative Hertas, is when do we step in to do the people's work? Do we do that when we're in tough economic times when the people are suffering? Or do we wait until things are in a rebound economically so that we have excess resources available to the common good? It's a tough decision for both parties, absolutely. But the point is that you have tremendous need that's only gotten worse over the last few years, precisely because we've had the economic downturn. Now, I was here, Madam Chair, and so were you. I think we're the only two members here. You know, a decade ago when we did massive tax cuts in this state. And frankly, there were only 15 legislators in the House floor who stood up and voted against those cuts, one Republican and 14, I think, Democrats. And we said at that point, look, you know, looks like a gravy train right now, but we're creating the possibility of massive structural instability for this state, which in the end means we're going to wind up doing what we did relative to these programs several years later. Now, I would have preferred not to have been a prophet at that time. I would have preferred to have been proven wrong, but unfortunately, Madam Chair, we were proven right. And so, you know, the issue of government spending is absolutely a legitimate issue to put on the table, but also is the issue of whether or not we're making wise decisions when we do the kind of massive tax cuts that we did 10 years ago, because when you cut through all the politics, at the end of the day, it means whether or not we're going to be able to walk with little earth to be able to combat poverty and be able to stabilize Minnesota communities. And so it's a big philosophical debate. Representative Hertas and other members is here. It's not even necessarily a partisan debate. There were a lot of Democrats who voted for those tax cuts 10, 12 years ago. But I think it's important as we have this conversation that it isn't just about government spending that's on the table. It's also the kind of decisions that we make relative to revenues and tax policies. Representative Isaacson, I apologize. I'm kind of derailing your bill here. You have a wonderful bill that stands on its own. There's tremendous need. And I certainly want to stand with you in terms of responding within the restraints that we have. Mm-hmm. You know, and we do have very real restraints to be able to respond responsibly.
Representative Isaacson, before you give your final word, we do have one request from the audience testimony. Jean Lee, and then I think we have time for just one person because we didn't get this request until just now, and I really we'll have to have just one person speak. Ms. Lee, are you the one who's going to be speaking?
Are you the one speaking?
I'm the one speaking, but they will introduce themselves.
Okay. That's fine.
Madam Chair,
welcome
members
to the committee.
Of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, which is shelters, transitional housing, and permanent housing, and also head the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, made up of over 20 service provider organizations covering a broad base and comprehensive range of cultural and bilingual services for the community and veterans. These include things like education, training, employment, health care, housing, legal services, children and family services, elderly services, victim services, and veteran services. And I want to introduce to you some of the members who came today to testify, who are members, and being that we were told that we only have 3 minutes, I'm going to try to be brief and just let them introduce themselves and maybe some food.
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin Vang from the Hmong Eating Council, which is the non-profit organization that represents the Hmong community in Minnesota. So my name is Kevin Vang, the chairman for the organization. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Vang.
Madam Chair and a member of the House, I'm from the New American and American community, and particularly I represent the Hmong American Mutual Association from Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Robert Lohr, also from Hmong Eating Council here in Minnesota.
And welcome to the committee. And
I'll continue. Okay. We work to with the populations most in need and of help and services, but who receive the least help and services unless we do it. We provide the most bang for the buck and return on investment than other nonprofits for the same funds. But we still have barriers to overcome as far as discrimination and other barriers to access to funding, and that's why we sought policy changes needed. We have strategic, unique strategies. We'll be giving you a copy of this since it goes, you know, a lot as far as follow-up, and they'll have some of their testimony also that they'll follow up on and send to you. Basically, we're trying to create jobs and enhance and provide, build capacity in doing the services. We do have requests as far as the need for funding for providing services, education, and training for the unserved and underserved populations. And we go beyond just serving the Asian community. We also seek restoring funds that have been cut from because they were tied to the tobacco funds. In your pamphlet, there's what they call the NCHEC certification. We provide collaboratively. We have full service, full home ownership services, and I indicated it's come at a cost to us individually versus other large organizations receiving funds for it. And this, a smaller organization, we have to pay for it ourselves. We're asking for reform and redesign that's needed in state agencies. I just wanted to raise a couple House files that that you folks should consider as far as the content to that we introduced to overcome some of the barriers. House File 837, which relates to the protection of our client data and being used in competition with our grantees. House File 993, that reduces the inequities of current law in the subcontractor as far as giving priority in funds to larger organizations over smaller organizations, and many of them were minority organizations. House File 1024 that informs the consumer of choices in housing counselors that are certified by Congress's Neighbor Works America and the Minnesota Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Association.
Excuse me, Ms. Lee. This is where we're talking to a specific bill right now,
yes.
This bill, and I think that's what we're most interested in, and I think you've addressed that. And I have a question, I think, from Representative Moran. We're going to have to wrap it up because we have several other bills and we didn't know you were coming until the last minute.
So in summary, I think we could all say that we support an increase in funding and access to the funding. And
okay, thank you. Representative Moran?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to speak on behalf of your group and others group from minorities community that sometimes see that there's barriers that are in place because they don't have the capacity. They may be smaller organizations who don't have the capacity, but are working and targeting culturally specific groups of people where relationships, you know, is really, really important to how they are able to support community members. And just hope that in the midst of, as we look to funding housing, that we also look to smaller culturally appropriate organizations to support them and guide and direct them through that process so that they too are getting the funding and the support that they need to end homelessness and also support home ownership. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Are you completed? We need to wrap it up here with Representative Isaacson.
Okay.
And thank you very much for coming today, each of you, you know, it's possible we may be able to have an informational hearing again in the future. Representative Isaacson, you have the final word.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and we'll forward the information that you weren't able to hear.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson?
Madam Chair, we have spoke a few times in the past and talked about how we can be a service, and I'm going to be visiting that issue with you, as I've also directed that group to be in touch with you as well.
Thank you.
I'm going to just say a few brief words, and then we're going to move on. I really think it's time for us to think about, as we crawl out of this recession and where we're at, and we have a recovery, that we need to make sure we provide opportunity for all people to crawl out of this recession and experience recovery. And I think that's part of our responsibility here. Not only because, as I said before, I think it's morally the right thing to do, I also think it's important to understand the fiscal benefit of doing that as well, so I can speak to both sides of that. I think that in terms of looking at social programs and some of the stereotypes that go with it, one of the things that struck me about this program and the folks, as you heard from the testimony, that I think is really important is the level of accountability and understanding they have that they need to measure their outcomes too, and they need to be successful in what their endeavors are. And I think that's a really admirable thing that we saw here. Folks that were talking about taking responsibility for their lives and making their lives better, they just needed a little boost. And that's what I think our responsibility is. Our responsibility is to provide opportunity. That's our job. And that's what this bill does, is it helps us take the right steps forward to providing opportunity. I think we're also in a situation where we can lead for this house. We can lead for this house out of this committee. It's a rare combination of people in here, both Democrats and Republicans, that I think have shown a real thoughtful determination to do the right thing. I think they've shown a real thoughtful determination to get our numbers right, which I really appreciate. Shout out to you guys. I also think that it's important that we keep in mind both sides, as Representative Hertas and Mariani talked about, this idea of how we're going to pay for it and making sure also we have the outcomes that we are there. Where I will not equivocate is that it is our responsibility to do so. And that's the part I will not back down on, and that's the part of why I support this bill. I think that in the future, as we move forward, if we're able to give them the support that we want them to have, it's our job also to hold them accountable. And they have assured me they're going to be doing that themselves, and it's our job to work with them and walk with them in that process to make sure that we're successful in really working towards ending homelessness and working with those homeless youth. So that I'll renew my motion to lay it over for inclusion in the omnibus.
Any further discussion? Okay, members, then that bill is laid over for further discussion. Possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, we have two bills left. One of them, I'm going to be presenting both of them, so I'm going to ask Representative Bly to take over.
Thank you.
exodus of some of our taxpayers. Okay.
Representative Clark, would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we have a number of witnesses. I want to make sure that we have some time. This is a bill that's House File 1445. I'll move that it be passed, and it'll be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance because it has some information in there, or some requirements in there for the Department of Health. Mm-hmm. And just basically talk with you very briefly about this bill. What we're trying to do here is establish, actually kind of reestablishing in some part a grant program within the Department of Health for healthy housing type of grants, and it's focused on looking at our home environments, dealing with the issues of chemical, biological, physical agents that can cause harm to human health in our homes. And there's several grant programs in there. One is the education and training grant. Another is an implementation grant for the healthy homes. And then the last thing that this bill does is put funding back into lead poisoning prevention activities. And I'd like to ask the committee, the witnesses who have come here today to make that present some of the information about why we need this program.
Okay.
So Zach Hansen.
Okay.
Dan.
Representative Clark moves her House File 1445 to be passed and referred to Health and Human Services.
Maybe we can just have them each come down. So we.
Yes.
Dan Simoniak, Sam Walseth, and I believe we have a Representative Clearcore here too.
Okay, would you please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Zach Hansen. I'm the Environmental Health Director for the St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health. I'm thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm testifying on behalf of the local Public Health Association of Minnesota, which represents city, county, and tribal public health departments across the state, and testifying in support of this bill's focus on healthy homes. Our experience in St. Paul and other cities in Ramsey County has been that there's a strong connection between housing and health. We've worked quite diligently over the last more than two decades on childhood lead poisoning using both primary and secondary prevention tactics. And we've worked also on radon, asthma, mold, injury prevention, chemical poisonings. And we've learned that it makes much more sense to approach these issues from a whole house perspective rather than a one-by-one perspective. One of the things we did in Ramsey County was, working with the City of Minneapolis, secured federal HUD funds in 2006. And to take our experience in lead and lead hazard control and take it to a healthy homes approach. That work eventually transitioned to a second grant with the American Lung Association of Minnesota. And using funds from these two grants, we were able to work in over 160 houses that were occupied by children with severe asthma. And those are kids that generally use the emergency department for their primary care. So the focus was to try to look at the environmental triggers in the home to make healthier kids and to increase the amount of time they were in school. Minneapolis addressed over 175 homes in that. Most of these were older properties in lower, which had lower housing values and lots of issues. Now, while our focus was to reduce environmental triggers of asthma, we also investigated other risks, such as exposure to lead, exposure to radon, looked at humidity and mold issues, as well as injury issues or safety issues in the home. Now, the results were fairly spectacular. We saw significant, statistically significant reduction in the onset of asthma, increases in school days attended, and reduction in the use of the emergency department. So we had more days in school, reduced health costs, and healthier kids. But importantly, we also learned that we were able to identify and address other risks in the house and reduce related health risks to kids and their families. Now, last year, we, St. Paul Ramsey County, was one of seven departments that was funded by the State Health Department to carry out a similar approach. And until that funding was reduced by the federal government, which discontinued the program, we were able to get into 26 additional properties with similar results. And that validated a whole home approach to these issues. It also validated that it's far more efficient and effective to take a healthy housing or a whole house approach rather than one by one. So there is a clear connection between housing and health, just like there's a connection between health in the workplace and health in the community. Healthy homes are dry, clean, well-ventilated, pest-free. We know that. Addressing these in one comprehensive manner rather than one by one has at the local level been demonstrated to be more efficient use of resources and more effective for the families in those homes. The local Public Health Association supports policies that promote early intervention to remove lead and other hazards through a healthy homes approach before children are exposed. The local Public Health Association concurs with the recommendations of the state's Minnesota Healthy Homes Strategic Plan and supports the work that will implement the strategies of those plans. House File 1445 takes us in that direction. We're pleased that it includes state-administered grants to local public health to decide at the local level how best to approach a healthy home. And we're also pleased that the bill includes sufficient funding for the statewide lead surveillance program, which will maintain that database and provide us at the local level with information about children with elevated blood lead levels. Thank you.
Thank you. At your next testifier.
There we go.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Dan Simonic. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I supervise the Lead Poisoning Prevention and Healthy Homes Program. I had testified before you a couple of weeks ago, and so we won't go over all the details in the background and what's a healthy home and all the conditions that we, it's still the same as what we said a couple of weeks ago. I guess what we're here to just emphasize is that the types of approaches that are emphasized in these bills are entirely consistent with a public health approach, with getting in front of an issue, and as you heard the testimony here, getting out and housing and making people's lives be better. We did put together a little summary that kind of goes over the different parts of the bill, and you can read that. On the back of that, we included some of the data that again reemphasizes that these are significant issues that do affect real people across the country and here in Minnesota. I also included just kind of an overview of the Alliance for Healthy Homes, which is another large group that's coming together of nonprofits and government agencies and lots of the diverse people involved in this issue coming together to work together. I was struck listening to the conversation on the previous bill how in describing the work they're doing in those communities and getting in there and helping folks and being able to turn around those kinds of communities, that in fact that is exactly the kind of effort that the Healthy Homes Program would work with to ensure that the things that they're doing maximize the health benefit in their homes. That if they do have a mold problem, that they fix it correctly, that if they do have asbestos in there, they know how to handle that, that if they do run into pests, that they're able to use an effective measure on that. And so I was very struck by the fact that that's exactly the kind of program that we will work with and ensure that that works better. So as has been said before, I did bring a copy of the strategic plan. You can see there's lots of information as to ideas as to where to go. So a lot of people have given thought as to exactly to go through this. I think we're, even though we only get one quarter of the funding, I think that's entirely appropriate that work, because really this is going to happen at the local level where people understand their housing issues and understand the populations that they have to deal with. And so we think it's a would be very supportive of our overall public health efforts.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, would you like to ask your question now or wait until they're all done? Okay, thank you. Mr. Walseth.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, Sam Walseth, and I represent a nonprofit organization called the Sustainable Resources Center, who's presented in front of this committee and other health committees in the past. I guess we're representing kind of the third leg of this initiative here today. The bill before you provides funding for state leadership and responsibility by way of Healthy Homes Initiative, local public health associations, and also an important role for nonprofit organizations who are very capable of providing a local resource to the public and communities in improving the healthy homes and taking this Healthy Homes Initiative statewide. Specifically, the Sustainable Resources Center has assisted in weatherization, lead abatement, worker training, lead safe work practices, public education outreach in the past, and would be have been very much involved in the Healthy Homes Alliance and moving this initiative forward. We really appreciate Representative Clark's bill here today, taking this kind of from a pilot project into a statewide initiative. And with that, we urge your support to continue moving this initiative forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clark, do you have any remarks you'd like to make?
Just that that this is brought to you partly because we have some cuts to these programs from the federal level, as was described by several of the witnesses. And, we don't have fewer housing-related health problems. We actually have more. And so this is something that I believe that we as a state should take some responsibility for, and particularly in the area of dealing with childhood lead poisoning. This is the intervention program with the little kids. That's been discontinued from the federal level, and so if we don't put anything back in place at the state, we will not have an intervention program for our little toddlers. So I wanted to just mention that and ask for your support, members. I think there's going to be one technical amendment that I can either do now, or we can do it after it's in the full committee when we're looking at the omnibus bill. And that's on line 2.5. If you just look at that, it said the commissioner shall make a grant. Well, it should say to qualified nonprofit organizations, so it should have an S there. This will be more than, it'll be more than one organization. So, as potential, as long as they're qualified. So I just wanted to, we don't have to do that today, but I just wanted to tell you that's what my intention is.
Okay,
and I'll be glad to take any questions.
Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, you mentioned radon. I think that's very good. And just asking, especially if this program is going to be launched statewide, how do you get the word out to make people aware that this is available and to let people know?
Good question. I'm going to ask our health department, who's going to be in charge of that. Question.
State your name again for the
Dan Simonic from MDH, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Actually, the Alliance will be very helpful in doing that, as they have representatives across the whole state. In fact, you've hit on one of the challenges, is now that we have this good information, how, in fact, do we get it out? That's why we're trying to work with builders groups, with retailers and hardware stores, those kinds of things. The local grants will be going out around the state, so they'll have local coalitions developing there. And, in fact, the organizations that will get the training grants also, we fully expect that will have a statewide coverage. So it will be a challenge, but it's one we've given some thought to, and we think we can get it out there.
Any other questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak to this bill? Seeing none. Representative Clark, would you like to renew your motion?
Yeah, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1445 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Nope.
No, excuse me, this is going to Health and Human Services. Excuse me, I'm on to my next one already. Yep. This one goes to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Representative Clark renews her motion that the bill be passed, that House File 1445 be passed and referred to Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Bill passes. All right, the next bill.
Mr. Chairman, and I hope I can be fairly brief. You've heard this bill before. I'll move House File 1055, be recommended to pass. This needs to go to the Tax Committee. And so
Do you have an amendment for this?
I do, and it's in your packet, members. It's the A2 amendment, and we brought this to the committee last time when we actually went over this bill, but it hadn't gotten in 24 hours ahead of time, so we're bringing it back today and doing the proper adding of it. And if you recall what we're doing in this bill, and the reason I mentioned this bill earlier, Representative Anderson, is this is one of the ways we think we can help provide some of the financing and that would provide some of the funding for all the needs that we heard about earlier with Homes for All and so on. This dedication of